We're back, Scaredy Cats, and it is time to take on one of the most influential but also weirdest horror movies of all time, Dario Argento's 1977 classic Suspiria. It was followed by Inferno in 1980 and The Mother of Tears in 2007. These three movies make up the Three Mothers trilogy, which tells the tale of the Mothers of Sorrow, three witches who wreak evil havoc on the world. The narrative of the movie is pretty incidental. It's really the visuals and the score that make Suspiria the legend that it is. So grab yourself some red wine, sit back, and relax, because this is going to be a wild ride.
Roses are red, violets are blue, but the iris is the flower that will mean the end of you.
You can run from Suspiria.
For this episode, the Werewolf Squad reunites, but this time it's all about witches. Although I feel like with this movie, we could probably work some werewolf hijinks in there. Hi, Jessica. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Hi, sure. Werewolf Squad represent. I'm Jessica Scott. I'm a horror writer. You can find me on Twitter at We Who Walk Here, talking about werewolves, witches, and haunted houses usually. I'm super excited to be back. Suspiria is one of my favorite horror movies. I have a huge Suspiria tattoo on my arm, so I'm very, very excited and a little nervous to talk about this movie.
Oh, what's the tattoo of?
It is, in the background, it's the stained glass window, the yellow stained glass window from the opening. Mm-hmm. And then there's a peacock on top of that to kind of call to mind the peacock figurine at the end of the movie. So it's kind of full circle.
Yeah, nice. The literal bird with the crystal plumage at the
end
of the movie.
Exactly.
I'm Brian Kuiper. I am a film writer and around the internet. Bloody Disgusting mostly, but also Manor Vellum and Council of Zoom are main places you can find my writing. I'm also a podcaster on Movies for Life podcast with Michelle Egan. And Suspiria is one of those movies that intimidates me a little bit, I gotta admit.
Really?
So do you remember the first time you saw Suspiria and what your reaction was?
I do, for sure. I was sitting in the exact same room I'm sitting in right now as we record, actually. My sister and I caught literally the last 30 seconds of the movie on the Sci-Fi channel before it was S-Y-F-Y, when it was actually spelled like sci-fi.
Skiffy.
For the older crowd listening. we caught the very tail end when the Academy is on fire and Jessica Harper is walking away smiling and laughing. And we looked at each other and said, "What the hell is this?" And, you know, luckily in those days, a lot of times, as soon as a movie would end, the channel would replay it from the beginning. And it said, "You have been watching Suspiria." And then the thing popped up and said, "Next up, Suspiria." And we were like, "Well, fuck yeah, of course we're going to watch this." So we sat down and watched it again. I was far more engrossed with it than my sister was. She was like, "This is weird. What the hell?" But I was like, "This is my new religion." So I have a very, very vivid memory of the first time I saw this movie.
I love that.
So the first time that I even heard of this movie was years and years ago. Bravo did this 100 greatest moments in horror countdown. Mm-hmm. You guys remember that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was, and I was kind of obsessed with that for a while. And I remember the Suspiria one coming up. And at the time, I had never heard of it. So this was the early 2000s. And it actually kind of, because they showed part of the trailer, you know, where they put roses are red. So it's that weird voice. Roses are red, violets are blue, the iris in, it'll be the end of you. And it turns around, it's a skull.
Classic.
Love it.
It actually, like, I mean, and, you know, I was in my 20s. I wasn't like a little kid. But it really disturbed me. It kind of freaked me out. But then I was like, I have to see whatever this is. And so I kind of started searching around for it. This was, at the time, I wasn't even thinking about, you know, looking on Amazon or even eBay or something like that. And I just started watching for it. So I actually found it at Half Price Books one day, and which, you know, like a used bookstore chain, and it was a cropped, you know, washed out, probably VHS transfer, may well have been a bootleg edition of Suspiria. And I think I'm pretty sure I got rid of that one because I don't really need that anymore. But I watched it and was just like, what the hell is this? I did not. It was just so strange. And then I caught it again on TV. You know, and I think it might have been an earlier iteration of Joe Bob or something.
Okay.
And because I remember him talking about the maggots and this falling from the ceiling and stuff. And okay, all right, I'm going to give this another try. And so I watched it on that too. And I've seen it since then a couple more times. But at first it was just, I don't really know what I'm looking at. And then, you know, actually seeing it in this sort of beautiful, pristine, you know, because I saw it a couple years ago on DVD and it looked great. I like the Synapse DVD. And then I saw it just today on the 4K transfer. And holy shit, that is a remarkable difference that makes rather than the VHS transfer I watched it on initially. So it's... But yeah, so there are a lot of things, but I remember even from that Bravo countdown, they actually showed the first kill. And I was, again, very disturbed by that because it's intense, man. That's intense. So, but it's we'll talk still, about yeah, that when shocking. We talk about that.
Yeah. Y'all, so. I'm getting ahead of myself too. I'll stop.
That's okay. Yeah, I remember seeing it for the first time. So had a similar reaction, and this is terrible, and I hate that I'm going to admit this, but I was probably around 20 and I had this huge crush on this very serious horror film guy, and he loved Italian horror. That it was his thing. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to get into this, and then we'll have something to talk about, because he didn't really like the same kind of horror that at that time I liked. Mm-hmm. So I bought Suspiria, and I bought Fulci's Zombie.
Nice.
And watched them. And Zombie, I loved. Like, right away, I was like, this is amazing. Suspiria was a little, I had kind of a similar reaction where I'm like, what am I watching? But I really liked the music. I really liked the visuals, but didn't really kind of get into it until I got a little older and watched it again. And the more I watch it, the more I fall in love with it, I would say. But yeah. Thank you, Lee, for putting me onto Italian horror. So the IMDb summary is: an American newcomer to a prestigious German ballet academy comes to realize that the school is a front for something sinister amid a series of grisly murders. Fair enough. So it was directed by Dario Argento and written by Argento and Daria Nicolodi.
Yes, I'm wearing my Daria Nicolodi t-shirt right now, just FYI.
So it's based in part on Thomas de Quincey's essay Suspiria de Profundis from 1845. But Nicolodi and Argento wrote the screenplay, and it combined these occult films that interested both of them with fairy tales such as Bluebeard, Pinocchio, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Nicolodi apparently also partially based her contributions in the screenplay on a personal story her grandmother had told her, in which her grandmother had gone, she took a piano lesson at an unnamed academy where she thinks she encountered black magic. This terrified her grandmother. She fled the piano academy and never came back. Supposedly, this is also fabricated. So it's a good story.
I choose to believe that it is true.
Also, I choose to believe Nicolodi, who said that her grandmother was actually a white witch and had healing powers.
Also true, yes.
Yeah.
The movie they chose to set at a dance academy in Freiburg, which is basically right by the Black Forest near the German border with Switzerland and France. So the original idea was that the ballet school would be for younger girls, so basically no older than about 12. But the studio denied that request because they didn't want to film this violent involving children.
I can't imagine, you know, you think of like the opening kill or the razor wire scene, right? with like 8, 9, 10, 12 year olds.
I thought this movie was bananas with adults. Like, Argento is a madman. I love it.
He really is. Yeah. But you can see kind of, he didn't rewrite the script. So he did cast older actresses, but didn't rewrite the script. So there are scenes where you're like, oh, I can see this playing as 12-year-old girls. Like, you think about the locker room scene, which we'll get to.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the doorknobs that are at about the same height as the actors' heads so that they have to raise their arms like a child would raise their arm to open the door.
Yeah, that's true.
There's enlarged set pieces that are made to dwarf the actors so that it, again, feels like they're little children.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating.
It is, isn't it? American actress Jessica Harper was cast in the lead role of Susie Banyan after attending an audition via the William Morris Agency. And Argento chose her specifically because he loved her performance in Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise. Argento requested Italian actress Stefania Cassini for the supporting role of Sarah. And she was a big admirer of his film. So she was like, let's do this. That role originally had supposed to have been played by Daria Nicolodi, but she hurt her ankle just before shooting and was not able to actually fulfill the role. So Joan Bennett was cast as Madame Blanc because of her association with director Fritz Lang, who Argento greatly admired. And we also had the actress who played Helena Marcos was actually not credited. Supposedly, according to Jessica Harper, she was a 90-year-old former prostitute that Argento found on the streets of Rome.
So many of these things are so intriguing. Like, I really want to know more about, he just randomly found a 90-year-old prostitute on the street and cast her in a movie. And we've got, you know, a piano school full of witches. People are leaving out a lot of details that I would like to know.
That's true. That is true.
It's funny. A certain amount of them sound like, really? You know, is that true or is that a legend?
Right.
It's sort of print, a lot of print the legend kind of things, I'm sure. Yeah, but, you know, those are fun too.
So the film was shot over 4 months, the majority of which was in Rome. But there was additional photography in Munich, including Daniel's death scene. Spoiler alert, Daniel dies. as well as the airport, the scene with the two professors. Sorry, not the one professor and the psychologist.
The Udo Kier, yeah.
That's shot at the BMW headquarters.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow.
The cinematographer Luciano Tavoli was hired by Argento to shoot the film based basically on color film tests he had completed, because Argento wanted this kind of snow white feel. And he really liked the way that Tavoli played with color, which is interesting because apparently Tavoli generally had a very naturalistic style when he was shooting prior to this movie. In an interview with ASC Mag, Tavoli said, "I decided to intensively utilize primary colors, blue, green, and red, to identify the normal flow of life. and then apply a complementary color, mainly yellow, to contaminate them. A horror film brings to the surface some of the ancestral fears that we hide deep inside us, and Suspiria would not have had the same cathartic function if I had utilized the fullness and consolatory sweetness of the full color spectrum.
That's amazing. I think I ran across that article that I was like, I'm going to bookmark and read that before we record. And then, of course, I didn't. I just kept it in an open tab on my phone that I still haven't read. But I love hearing stories like that.
It's a great article. He later goes on to say, you say to yourself, this will never happen to me because I have never seen such intense colors in my life. This makes you feel reassured and at the same time, strangely attracted to proceed deeper and deeper into this colorful journey. So let's talk a little bit about the score.
Goblin.
Credited Italian as frog the goblins band. In the movie.
Yeah. Goblin had previously scored Deep Red and then also did subsequent films following Suspiria with Argento. It's such an incredible soundtrack. It's so weird. And I don't know. Tell me your thoughts on the score.
It's terrifying. And we'll get to it, but the way they time it, some of the moments where, yeah, which there are specific moments that they time to that moment in the song that just give me chills every single time. Mm. And I have several copies of the soundtrack. I like to listen to it when I'm driving alone at night in a thunderstorm because it's terrifying and makes me want to like hide under the covers, but I can't because I'm, you know, driving a car. But I just like scaring myself that way because it's such an eerie soundtrack and it's the perfect opportunity. But I, you know, at the top of the episode, Sherry, you mentioned, you know, it's famous mainly for its visuals and its score. And I really don't think this would be as legendary as it is without that score. It's just, it's so unique and it's so incredible and creepy and like kind of way too rockin' for a horror movie, but it's perfect. You know, I'm in love with it. Absolutely in love with it.
Yeah, it evokes a little bit. I mean, it's a very original score. I'm not saying that it's ripping anything off. That's not what I mean. But for me, it kind of evokes the tubular bells from The Exorcist, but also the Rosemary's Baby theme.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Where you have the voices in there, but instead of sort of being that sing-songy sound, it's sort of like, you know, it's grindy, it's whispery, and it's scarier when you have, well, not necessarily scarier, but it's trying to do something different by having the vocal inflection be so different. And one of the things I noticed is just how loud it is. I mean, it's really prominent. Mm-hmm. And sound in this movie is just really loud. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, that opening sequence is just, you're just hit by just constant sound as she's coming out of the airport and between the score and the rain and the wind and, you know, all of these things. And of course, being an Italian film, that was all added later.
Right.
You know, only recently have Italian films, you know, recorded sound live at that time, certainly, and before, you know, everything was dubbed later. So it's really a remarkable score and kind of unforgettable, really different than most of what you heard at the time. It's kind of presages the synthy thing. And sort of that relentless energy of so like the Halloween theme.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good stuff. It's such an onslaught, but it should be overwhelming. It should be really discordant, but it's not, you know, between all the neons that are in your face and all this weird music that's hitting you in the face the whole time, it should not work, but it does. And I think part of it is because it's got a bit of that fairy tale element to it. It does sound like you're walking alone in the woods as a little kid and there might be a witch nearby. There is that kind of twisted fairy tale element to it, which kind of brings it down enough where you're not like, God, this is too much for me. I can't it's just too much. It's just below the level where it would be overwhelming to where it's just perfection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brian, this has nothing to do with the score, but when you talked about like Italian films recording sound later, it made me think of a story I read where Jessica Harper talked about how she wasn't used to that. Being right. An American
most
actress.
American actors aren't.
And she said she'd be on set and that like there would be a stagehand pounding away with a hammer as they're acting. And she's like, what is going on?
Yeah. It was a common practice, though. Obviously you watch the spaghetti Westerns and everyone's speaking in whatever language they're speaking in. And the lips don't always match, depending on what country or what language it's being dubbed into. But that's also true of, you know, Fellini films and De Sica films and you name it, Rossellini. For lack of a better term, I'm sorry to even say this, you know, highbrow movies, you know, your critic favorite, critical darling kinds of movies. If it was Italian, you know, they came on set and they spoke whatever language they spoke.
It was released in Italy on February 1st, 1977. 20th Century Fox acquired the American distribution rights, but they were a little hesitant to release it based on its violent content. But they kind of came up with a shell company, International Classics, to release it in July 1977. The original American movie was cut by a total of 8 minutes. In order for the film to get an R rating, which I would love to know what 8 minutes they cut.
Yeah.
They'd have to cut the whole first scene. I mean, in that gorgeous Art Deco apartment building, at least.
Yeah.
The beating heart being stabbed.
Right.
I think. Despite this, of all of his films, of all of Argento's films, Suspiria was his highest grossing in the United States. However, I usually like to talk about box office and budget. It was really difficult for me to find any information about what the actual box office and budget was. The box office varied in like everywhere that I looked, so I'm not even going to talk about it.
Fair enough.
And reviews were very mixed. So Janet Maslin of the New York Times said it had slender charms, though they will most assuredly be lost on viewers who are squeamish. The Los Angeles Times' Kevin Thomas wrote that the film was consistently suspenseful and diverting, despite being marred by stilted, poorly dubbed English dialogue.
That's not an entirely unfair criticism,
though. to me, that's part of the charm, though.
I agree.
This was my first introduction to that kind of, you know, film, and I just thought it added so much to it.
Yeah, it's not a problem for me, but I did look at a couple of, you know, like, other Letterboxd reviews from just people that I've interacted with. I mean, so not anyone that's, some of them are critics, but you know what I mean? But some of them were like, this would be so great if it was a silent film, you know, if it was only the music and if there was not the dialogue, because the dialogue they found distracting. So, I thought it was funny.
Gene Siskel said that Harper's role was reduced to cowering in corners and she was costumed to look much younger than her years, but praised Argento's visually stylish direction. He also said that it plays like a weak imitation of The Exorcist.
Just insert me gasping in offense at every single one of these negative reviews.
Yeah, it's funny. Like looking through the reviews that I have, most of them were either mixed or negative. However, Dave Keir of the Chicago Reader said that Argento works so hard for his effects, throwing around shot cuts, colored lights, and peculiar camera angles, that it would be impolite not to be a little frightened.
Thank you.
Right? It's impolite. Somebody from the Village Voice said that it's a movie that makes sense only to the eye. But yeah, I think critics were very mixed or just really didn't like it, which I can see it being a polarizing movie because I think every one of us said that the first time we watched it, we went, what am I watching right now?
Yeah, but to me, that was a good thing. I can understand why people would be turned off by it, I suppose. I begrudgingly accept it.
All right. So the movie starts with this kind of crescendoing dissonance over the credits before the theme that will kind of play throughout the movie begins. And a voiceover introduces us to Susie Banyan, a young ballet dancer who will be attending a celebrated dance school in Freiburg, Germany. It's very precise. Like, the voiceover tells us what time she left New York, what time she arrived in Germany. Why? Why did they do that? I have a theory in it, but I want to hear what you guys think.
I think it's kind of like, I mean, it's kind of like Alice in Wonderland. Like, you're leaving this very orderly world where everything makes sense. Like, the first shot we see after the title card and some of the credits is the arrivals screen with the flights mm-hmm. coming in. You know, everything's very orderly. We know what to expect. This is the real world. And then we've got this airport terminal flooded with red light for some reason. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when she looks at the doors that go out into this world she's about to enter, all the ambient noise drops out and she hears that score. Then we cut back to her and everything's normal. There's the bustle of the airport, people talking. Everything is orderly and normal and safe. Then we go back to the doors and we hear that score again. It's like we're going from the real world into this magical, malevolent world. And I think they set it up at the beginning to be like, you know, and even the guy doing the narration sounds very straight-laced, very, you know, mm-hmm. orderly and reassuring. And then she's thrust out into this world where there's a storm, this wild music is playing, people aren't communicating with her in a way that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, when the taxi driver, she keeps saying, Escherstrasse, Escherstrasse. And he looks at the paper and says, oh, Escherstrasse. Like, he couldn't understand
her. Yeah. She says it right. Yeah,
she says it right. Like, it's right away, nothing makes sense in this world. She's just thrown into turmoil. And from then on, nothing in the movie makes sense. It's, she enters a literal different world to me. That's what it's about.
So that lines up perfectly with my theory, but you said it way better than I could. Thank you.
Thank you.
And even like, as she's walking through the concourse, like, the use of color is so evident right away. Like, so mm-hmm. she's dressed all in white. She's got this kind of lilac scarf on, but everyone around her, for the most part, are dressed in red or yellow. Mm-hmm. So there's the little kid with the yellow overalls and the red shirt. There's somebody else wearing a red dress. Like, so that red and yellow is like right there, right away, but in more of a normal, like you said, orderly world kind of way.
Right.
There's that close-up of the door, the automatic door, the hardware, mm-hmm. as she goes out. You know, and I think that kind of symbolizes her. Here's her entering this portal into another world.
Yes. Yeah.
So the storm is raging. They're driving to the school. We get to sightsee a little bit. And there's some weird close-ups. Like, there's that storm drain with rainwater emptying into it. There's some mini rapids in the river. And I think it just kind of shows that chaos that she's now going to experience.
Absolutely. I love that shot. And the shot of her in the taxi with all the different colored light coming in, I kept making notes. Like, this is one of those movies where there are far more iconic shots than should be allowed to be in one movie. And that's one of them, her in the cab with the light coming in as she's like soaking wet. Like, there are so many iconic moments and visuals in this movie. And that's the first one that I remember. Like, I caught my breath, like, God, that's gorgeous.
We see these very spooky woods, actually the Black Forest, mm-hmm. and get little flashes of light that are coming from within before we see that it's actually the taxi driving past. So it's even disorienting to the viewer, like, because at first I was like, oh, that's them passing the forest, but no, it's them coming through the forest.
Yeah. And the first time the headlight actually flashes in our lights is the first time the word witch is said on the soundtrack. Every time a light flashes at us, we hear witch, you know, it happens repeatedly. And that's the first time.
So we pull up to the school and it is this red ornate building. So the facade of the school was actually built on a soundstage, but it was based on the real life Whale House in Freiburg. So we see this young woman, her name is Pat Hingle, which we will learn later, in the doorway. And she's saying something as she stands there, but we don't quite hear what she's saying. And she runs past Susie as Susie's coming up the stairs. Susie buzzes the little buzzer, but somebody denies her entry. And so she has to retreat back to the taxi. As they drive by the woods again, we see Pat stumbling through the woods before she ends up at this apartment building, which is also painted a muted red on the interior. And she has gone to see a friend, Sonia, who offers to let her stay as long as she needs to. So Pat's very agitated. It's not about being expelled from school, but she can't explain it to her friend because it's so weird, she says.
And I'm kind of obsessed with Pat's physical performance, like the jerky way she runs through the trees with the wailing on mm-hmm. the soundtrack and the way she moves when she's in the apartment. Like, she's clearly traumatized. When Sonya reaches out to touch her hair, she jerks back and just, she doesn't move in a natural way. Like, she's already kind of under their spell. And I just, mm-hmm. I'm really astonished by that performance physically.
So she goes to dry off in the washroom because, like we said, it's been raining and she is just drenched, but she gets frightened when the wind blows the window open. Right. The
wind. It was the wind.
Yes. Wink, wink. So Sonya comes in, she comforts her. She's like, you're going to tell me what's going on. Like, you need to tell me. And there's this great shot of the exterior of the building, with Pat standing in the window mm-hmm. and there's this hanging laundry, which for some reason always makes me think of either New York or Italy, like laundry hanging outside of an apartment building like that. I don't know why. Probably Hollywood. And it's obscuring part of the window. The lighting outside is all blue and red. Pat's still clearly very on edge. And she seems like she thinks someone or something is watching her. She's peering out the window and it appears that there's actually a figure behind the laundry. And sure enough, we see this pair of disembodied eyes flash on the screen.
So creepy.
It's so creepy.
It is. It's terrifying. Like, this movie is scarier than I think some people give it credit for, just because it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it can be both at once, and it is, you know.
She doesn't get away from the window fast enough, and an arm breaks through the glass and grabs her, and it squishes her face against the window. Like, it's – her face is squished uh-huh, against that window. Uh-huh. These are apparently Dario Argento's arms, by the way.
Yeah, he always said he had to be the killer. Like, every time someone gets stabbed in one of his movies, he is the one with those black gloves on.
The black gloves, yeah. Her friend hears the commotion. She runs out of the apartment. Like, first she tries to get in, then runs out, mm-hmm. trying to get help from her neighbors, crying, help, there's a murderer. But no one comes to assist them.
I have to wonder if the witches might not make it so that no one could hear her.
Maybe.
Because they're quite powerful. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I think that either, you know, the witches kept the doors closed or kept other people from hearing what was happening.
Meanwhile, Pat has been pulled through the glass and she is getting stabbed repeatedly by some unseen person. We don't see the person. We just see the very hairy arms.
Hairy arms. Really hairy.
Really hairy arms. Yeah.
Maybe that's the werewolf connection.
I thought it was Daniel's dog.
I was too. Yeah.
But there could be more than one werewolf.
There could be more than one wolf.
Yeah. See, I knew we would be able to tie a werewolf.
You will always bring it back to the werewolf squad.
I mean, we do see a full moon later on in the movie. So
yes, uh-huh.
The killer ties Pat up with like some wire that just happens to be sitting on the balcony, and she is in absolute agony. She gets stabbed right in the heart, which is very visible.
I mean, can you imagine stabbing someone so much that their heart actually is like exposed,
right? And
beating right there?
Oh my God.
I have to say, I love the blood red of Italian horror movies.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Me too. It's not realistic at all. And that's what's beautiful about it. It's brighter than real life.
Mm-hmm. It looks like red paint.
Oh yeah,
it does. Yeah. It does.
You know,
and this probably says more about me than anything. But I'm a knitter. I have a lot of yarn, and I had an indie dyer dye me up a skein of yarn to match this scene where Pat is lying on top of the stained glass window, getting stabbed in the heart. It's gorgeous.
I like that.
Yeah. I have not knit anything with it yet. I'm waiting for the right project. But when I do,
I'll
share it and be like, hashtag werewolf squad.
I love it. I love it. I always think like, because I also knit, and I was like, oh, I should get somebody to make me like the perfect yarn. But I always worry that I'm going to pick the wrong project for it.
Right. Yeah. And I know you can always frog it, but oh, I hate to do that. Anyway, this is not knitting talk. I'll let you get back to Suspiria.
Hey, I got to throw in, though, that I'm a knitter, too.
Yay!
And I'm not just saying that. I actually, just because I want to fit in, I actually do.
I mean, I believe we did have a conversation on Twitter about this before. So
yeah, I was going to say, Brian, we have talked about this on Twitter before, so we can attest that he's not lying.
Yeah. Exactly. Pat crashes through that beautiful stained glass into the lobby of the building, and the killer had fashioned a noose out of that wire. So when she crashes through the glass, she ends up hanging herself.
What's crazy, though, it's how it's around her waist. This is something that really, really disturbed me when I first saw the scene, was that it's like around her waist and arms, and then it slides up to her neck.
Yeah.
And just the way she suddenly stops.
Yes.
And, you know, and sort of the tongue lolling out and everything about that was just, I mean, for me, that was the worst part of the kill in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's even though it's technically, you know, not the one that is causing any of the bloodletting, it's just that look and it's horrifying. Mm-hmm.
And not like she would have survived having an open chest cavity with a stabbed heart, but she stops.
How she made it that long to even get to the hanging, I mean, is pretty amazing.
But she stops, you know, just a few inches above the floor. You're like, oh, you were so close, Pat, even though, you know, a million things would have killed her before that. But it's just the fact that she's so close to the floor is so disturbing to me, too.
Can I just throw something in?
Of course.
Saying the name Pat, when they say the name Pat Hingle, it makes me laugh, because do you know who?
Yes.
There's an actor named Pat Hingle. He's in Maximum Overdrive. He's the guy that runs the Dixie Boy, you know, with, you know, the bazooka, and, you know, he's the boss. He's the real jerk boss.
I know him from Splendor in the Batman, Grass.
The Tim Burton Batman.
Yeah, and I was a huge fan of Splendor in the Grass before this movie, so it always caught me off guard. Like, what the – Pat Hingle's in this movie? No.
That's really off subject.
No,
but
no, it's not.
Every time I can't remember which character it is, but in the next scene when they say, one of our girls, Pat Hingle, disappeared, I was like – it always makes me laugh, but I can't help it. Me
too. I do the same thing.
Man, Pat has this horrible death and you laugh.
Yeah, well, it's after, you know, I know.
The morning has passed.
Yeah.
But yeah, I will have a couple of off-subject stories, so don't feel out of place, Brian, because I'm going to find a way to work them in.
Awesome.
So unfortunately for Sonia, she has made it to the lobby by this point, but she is impaled by one of the metal beams from the stained glass, but it could also maybe have been the large shard of glass that's embedded in her face that killed her.
One of the two.
Could be. Oh my gosh.
Like, just that shard of glass, like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's basically bisecting her head.
Exactly.
It's so gruesome. Like, it's gorgeous. Like, the way it's shot and the colors and the composition, it's gorgeous, but it's also one of the most gruesome things you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
We head back to the school and we see a blind man, who we will later learn is Daniel, the school's pianist, walking his big-ass dog, German Shepherd, outside of the dance academy. At the same time, Susie arrives back at the school, where she meets Miss Tanner, played by Alida Valli, who is one of the instructors, and Madame Blanc, who is the vice directress. So Madame Blanc tells Susie of the tragic events of the previous night. She doesn't seem too broken up about it. And she says, I warn our students to be careful not to get involved with questionable friendship. She's probably one of my favorite characters in this movie, though.
She's so good. When I started watching Dark Shadows after I saw Suspiria, yes, I was really taken aback to see her in that show.
She wears this dress that is so out of place. Like, it seems much more in line with something that you would wear in like the 40s or maybe the 50s. Like, it's kind of got that, you know, that fit and flare style.
Yeah, absolutely.
They tell her that Susie's room isn't available. So she's actually going to be sharing a place with another student off campus. So was Susie staying in Pat's room? And that's why they're going to keep her off campus for now, because they need to search through Pat's room. Is that?
Perhaps.
I'm not sure why her room's not available.
I feel like Sarah would have mentioned something about that. But, you know, as we were talking about before we started recording, trying to make too much sense of the plot is probably a fool's errand. But I honestly, this will come up in a later moment, but when I come down to trying to figure out an element of the plot, it's just, these are in this universe, witches just want to screw up people's lives. They just like causing mischief. So just kind of messing with Susie's head and making her jump back and forth between Olga's apartment and the school is just a way to kind of screw with her. That's where I come down. They just like messing with people.
The actress that plays Olga, Barbara Magnolfi, I believe her name is. Yeah. She has actually said that she thinks that Olga was a witch in training, and that's why they wanted her to actually go and kind of take Susie under her wing.
I agree with that. Yeah. Okay. And that's a good segue for my first off-topic story.
Yes.
So I went to Texas Frightmare Weekend in 2017 and met Dario Argento, Claudio Simonetti from Goblin, Barbara Magnolfi, Stefania Cassini, Udo Kier. And had my picture taken with them, got to shake Dario Argento's hand and try not to cry and tell him how much I loved his work. So literally probably the best day of my life. But Barbara Magnolfi told this really interesting story that he came into her dressing room after the makeup artist had done her makeup for Olga, and he didn't like the way she looked. And he just said to Barbara, not to the makeup artist, he said, "Do your makeup like Olga would do it." And she was like, "What? The makeup artist just did my makeup. What are you talking about?" He said, "No, no, do your makeup like Olga." And then he just left. And she was sitting there puzzling over it for a while. And then she sat down to redo her makeup and do it like Olga. And it was the best way to get her into the character's headspace, because she sat down and thought, how would Olga do her makeup? How would Olga move? What would she do with her eyes and her lips? And it put her into the character's headspace better than any other director, because it went at it from a unique way and really made her feel like she was the character.
Huh.
And I love that story so much. And not just because I get to say that I met her, but because I think it's so interesting how directors work with actors and how actors work to find a character. And that's such a simple thing to do, but it's such a cool way to get into somebody's head.
Interesting. That kind of reminds me, and this is very off topic, but it's just when I very rarely wear makeup, very rarely. I either have to be like, I'm like, want to, like, well, if I'm doing something specific, then I will wear makeup. But often if I'm having a really bad day where I'm just like, you know, when you have those days where you're just not yourself and there's nothing really, like, there's nothing wrong, you're just feeling down.
Yeah.
And I will put on makeup to try and make myself feel better, because it's like putting on a mask to hide that. And I think there's a song by a band called La Tigra, and they say something about putting on eyeliner. I think I'll find that things are going to be fine and they're going to get much finer.
I love that song.
Me too. And that's what it makes me think of, is like when I do that, that's how I kind of, yeah, that's my completely unrelated mental health self-care tip that I do.
No, but that makes sense. Like, she's putting on the mask of Olga as she's sitting there doing her makeup, which helps her, you know, become the character more. That makes total sense to me. That's not off topic any more than mine was. But
so we next meet Pavlos, the Romanian handyman, as Miss Tanner starts showing Susie around. And she is mean. Like, she's like, "He's really ugly, isn't he? Oh, don't worry. He won't understand. He only speaks Romanian."
I'm pretty sure, like, smiling at him sarcastically and flashing your teeth over and over again will get the message across, even if you don't speak Romanian.
yeah, exactly. And in the locker room, we meet some of the other students. Miss Tanner tells Susie that she can borrow shoes from someone else until she gets her own. That's gross. I'm sorry. Like, borrowing someone else's dance shoes, like their ballet slippers? No. Ballet is hard on your feet.
That doesn't even make sense to me, because ballerinas have to mold shoes to their feet. Like, there are individual feet. It wouldn't, you would completely ruin someone's shoes if you borrowed them.
And you'd probably, like, they'd probably kill your feet. Like,
yeah.
Oof. So this is where we meet Olga, Susie's roommate, who is very slinky, a little snarky, and Sarah, a fellow American. Olga comes over to Sarah and Susie, and she says she once read that names that begin with the letter S are the names of snakes, and they degenerate into this juvenile exchange, like Susie sticking her tongue out, sorry, Sarah sticking her tongue out repeatedly, and Olga's making these hissing noises, and they kind of lean in over Susie.
And I love Susie's reaction, where she's just trying to pretend that she's anywhere else but here right now. But Olga is the snakiest one of all. Like, yes. she's so duplicitous, mm-hmm. and she moves in this really sinuous way. Like, mm-hmm. she moves like a cartoon cobra. I love that she's like projecting and telling everyone else they're a snake. I'm totally, you know, with Barbara Magnolfi. I think she's a witch, and I think a lot of the other students are witches.
It's such a weird little scene. It makes sense when you think that Argento wanted to cast much younger girls too. Mm-hmm. Like, when you think about them, like the way they go back and forth at each other, it's very little girl like. But it works.
Yeah.
But at her apartment, she comes across much nicer. Like, she's much friendlier to Susie.
Mm-hmm.
And that mesh overlay on her dress, I just have to say, I love everything about her outfit in this scene.
I'm obsessed with it. There's a reason I cosplayed that specific outfit, because I'm obsessed with it.
So this handsome young thing known as Mark shows up to drop off Susie's bags before anxiously leaving to get back to the school in time for dinner. It's really interesting to me the role of men in the movie, because there aren't many. There's Mark, there's Daniel, there's Pavlo, and then there's the professor and the psychologist later on. And then there's what's the little boy's name?
Albert.
Albert. Thank you. I was thinking Angelo, but yeah, Albert. And they're kind of incidental to the film.
Yeah, they're like servants or, you know, ineffectual in what they're supposed to be doing. It's mm-hmm. really interesting.
I read somewhere, I can't remember where it was, but they referred to Albert as Madame Blanc's familiar. Because she does, I'm very attached to him.
I'm so sorry. I'm obsessed with that because he kind of looks like a cat to me.
Yeah.
So now I'm just kind of picturing him as like she turned a cat into a human boy just to follow her around everywhere, because he never speaks.
Mm-mm.
Oh, God. No. I'm going to try not to just start randomly laughing at that during the course of this recording.
Well, if he was a cat turned into a boy, it would make sense that he'd be bitten by a dog.
Yes. We have solved this movie.
Oh, man.
Werewolf Squad.
There we go.
I love that. That's absolutely right. Yeah. Oh, God. I think I'm done. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. So Olga and Susie have this back and forth about Pat, and Susie's thinking about the glimpse she had of her the night before. She starts to remember some of the things she heard her say. It's like, secret, Iris. And we get these kind of flashback glimpses.
The editing at this point is amazing. Like, you've got a slow pan to a close-up on both Olga and Susie alternating between the two, and then the flashbacks. It makes it even more dreamy and like a fairy tale, because it's like they're both in their own different worlds, and then the flashback to this different world, and it's close-ups on all three of them, and it kind of sets up this other universe that Susie's in. It's gorgeous. The editing in that sequence is just jaw-dropping.
Olga thinks that Pat deserved to get kicked out of school. She was a bit of a troublemaker. Dance class the next morning for a movie about dance, about a dance school. There's not a lot of dancing going on, unlike the remake.
Oh, the remake has lots of dancing.
Yeah.
Lots of dancing. Yeah. So dance class the next morning is interrupted by Madame Blanc, who comes to see Susie to say, oh, we have your room ready for you now. But Susie's like, oh, I'd rather stay at Olga's. Like, I really like it there, which is not going to work for the witches. After class, Susie's walking down this red brocade hallway, and she sees an old woman who is one of the kitchen hands, and she's sitting in the hallway there on a chair polishing some silver. And there's Albert the cat lurking behind her. And she's polishing something just as a bright flash of sunlight reflects off of it into Susie's face, which kind of disorients her. It feels like it puts her under the witch's spell.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear that witch.
Yes. And in the moment where the light is shining in Susie's eyes, Albert goes from that totally neutral face to having a creepy grin on his face.
Yes.
And when the light goes away, his grin drops again. It's so frightening.
He's a creepy little kid.
Because he's an enchanted cat pretending to be a boy.
And they put him in those weird clothes.
Yeah, the little Lord Fauntleroy outfits.
Yeah, it's like, poor kid. Poor cat. Poor whatever.
Cat. Poor kid cat.
Yeah.
He can't catch a break.
Yeah.
So Susie, she tries to shake it off. She continues to walk down the hallway with quite a bit of difficulty. But now it's time for dance class in the yellow room. Susie is too weak to participate, and Miss Tanner pushes her. She's like, come on, let's go. You got this. Does Miss Tanner give anyone else Nazi vibes?
I was going to say that. Thunder stolen, but that's okay. She reminds me of the way... she reminds me of like a concentration camp guard, like a female Nazi concentration camp guard, you know, with her suit. And then there's this, the scene with where she's chewing out Mark. She looks like she's smiling. Yeah. It's so creepy looking.
Yeah.
And, she's like Ilsa, she wolf of the SS, you know, in a ballet school.
Yes. Absolutely.
Susie looks like she's going to pass out, but she gives it her best effort. Miss Tanner just keeps goading her until she finally collapses and she is bleeding from her mouth and nose, which is very convenient because now she's going to stay on campus, tucked into bed, presumably in the room meant for her. And Miss Tanner attempts to force her to drink water from a rather large decanter.
Right. She's like waterboarding her at this point. In her face, yeah.
The doctor, Professor Verdegast, says, you're just out of shape. That hemorrhaging is just from small ligament tears caused by the exertion. Don't worry, it'll be fine. Drink this wine, don't eat fruit, and you'll be good.
I want a doctor to tell me, don't exercise, don't eat fruit, drink alcohol.
Right?
You'll be right as rain in the morning.
Exactly. He gives her a shot. Olga conveniently has brought her bags to the school and... really nice. Didn't even take a cent of Susie's $50 rent payment. I would hope not. She was there for one night.
Right? But I love how obsessed every single person in the school is with money, especially...
That's literally my next line.
Thunder stolen again. I avenged Brian.
They are. They're all so obsessed with money. Mm-hmm.
It's because witches want to get rich and get power off the misfortune of others. And the students want to steal from people and just take all their money. I think there are a lot more witches than we realize.
True. And I mean, you think that the girl that she was going to take she was borrowing the shoes from. She's like, I'll sell them to you for this much money.
Right.
She's like, no, I've got my own coming. It's fine.
Yeah. Or maybe I'm just reading too much into it and the teachers kind of foster that environment where they want everybody to think about money all the time. But I like my theory about being a lot of witches.
Susie's new neighbor is Sarah, who pops in to see her and is shocked when Susie attributes her sudden recovery to the professor. But then the bell rings for supper. Sarah leaves to go get changed. And this leaves Susie with not much left to do besides comb her hair, you know, as you do. Find
this part.
A maggot in her hair. It's
not 70s Italian horror without a maggot scene.
And then more in her comb, because there is a downright infestation. They're all over the floor. The students are all freaking out. But no nonsense, Miss Tanner shows up and she's like, I'm going to find out where they're coming from. So they realize they're coming from the ceiling. So she takes Mark up into the attic with her. And the attic is lit in this gorgeous blue tone.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we get these close-up scenes of their shoes.
Their shoes crushing
the maggots.
Her stack heels. And yeah, just further adding to the Ilsa She-Wolf vibe.
So here's the source of the infestation. There is a wooden crate that is teeming, and I put in all caps, teeming, with... maggots. And inside there are even more maggots. And they're crawling all over spoiled food because something is literally rotten inside this dance academy.
Yep. You think there's a theme there. You think they're pointing out a theme. I can't tell.
I can't quite put my finger on it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Madame Blanc apologizes to the students the next day. She's like, while we're fumigating, we're going to turn the dance studio into a dormitory. It's going to be fun. It's going to be like a slumber party. She may not say those words, but, you know, that's basically what it's going to be. So the dance studio has these sheets hung up around the room. They enclose the students inside, which makes for some great shadows and visuals. Mm-hmm. Madame Blanc, Miss Tanner, and all the other teachers will also be sleeping in this makeshift dorm, which seems a little weird since it was only the students' floor that was affected and the teachers don't even live on the premises. But the lights go out, the room glows red, which red seems to signify danger in the movie. The girls start gossiping about Mark and how he appears to like Susie. It's kind of typical slumber party gossip. The music, there's this, like, it seems like a lot of heavy breathing and what sounds like cries as we watch the girls settle down to sleep. Behind Susie and Sarah, one of the teachers lays down behind the curtain and you can visibly see them breathing and then hear them snoring. It's just so creepy.
Yeah, that visual. Shadow visual is so cool, though. That's one of my, I mean, you were saying more iconic shots than should be allowed in a single movie. That, for me, might even be, how do you say, the best of them, but it's up there. It's really just a great ghostly silhouette, but it's red and it looks like she's floating and it's almost skeletal.
Yes. And there's something glowing in her head. Like there's something I don't know how they did it. I don't know how they did a lot of the stuff in this movie, but there's something about like a glowing element in where her head should be that always disturbs me so much.
Mm-hmm. Sarah wakes up and she's like, Susie, they lied to us. That snoring is coming from the directress because they had said that the directress had been away. And she's like, I've heard that noise before. It's apparently a very distinct snore. And it is. when Sarah whispers, she's here, she's there, right behind that sheet. I got chills, even though at the very first time I saw it, had no reason to fear the directress.
Right. They set it up so well because, you know, and she repeats herself a lot because she's already established that it's the directress behind the sheet. But then she says it again, just in case Susie missed it the first three times. Mm-hmm. But just to let you know, you know, this is the evil witch, the big bad right here. I love that moment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and I think just about every shot in this movie, even sort of the mundane ones, quote unquote, are sort of composed to make you feel uncomfortable or at least off kilter, in some kind of unease. I mean, everything. There's even, you know, like a shot later where she's just kind of laying in bed, you know, and one of the other girls is in there and it sort of pans over to the wall and there's just light on the wall. And something about that composition is just really unsettling.
Exactly.
And so this whole movie has all these unsettling compositions that, you know, so you just know that you're when it's ratcheted up like it is in that, you know, I mean, from a technical standpoint, you know, this is dye transfer technique of Technicolor, right? So they're ratcheting up that dye, that red dye, so it really stands out above any other color. And it's really disconcerting because red doesn't look like that when you see it in the real world. So,
yeah. And there are moments, especially in some of the overhead shots, like when you've got a bird's eye view of the dormitorium, or the dance studio where they've turned it into like a slumber party, basically, where it kind of distorts around the edge. And I don't know enough about camera lenses and things like that to be able to give an educated opinion on this, but just the way it distorts, you know, it feels like someone or something is floating above watching, and it just gives that sense of unease and unreality to everything. And that kind of distortion around the edge happens a lot, especially with those overhead shots. And it just, it makes it that much more frightening.
Yeah.
And they do it in the swimming pool scene too, right?
Like
they're swimming and then there's the overhead shot. It's exactly the same. Yeah. Like somebody's spying on them.
Yes. Yeah.
The night passes, although how the girls slept with the maggot trauma and then that snoring, I have no idea.
Me neither.
Sarah makes the potentially fatal mistake of asking Miss Tanner if the directress slept there the night before. But Miss Tanner's like, no, obviously she didn't. She's away. Miss Tanner, though, interrupts the dance class in the yellow room. Later on, she is on a mission and she berates Daniel, the blind pianist, saying, your dog attacked Albert. Daniel sticks up for his dog and he's like, Albert must have done something to provoke him. Like he wouldn't have just done this, but if he's a cat.
Well, right before we hear Albert screaming, he like walks straight up to the dog and opens his eyes wider than a human boy should be able to. So clearly he's, you know, put some kind of a spell on the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, my notes at this point say that evil little kid.
So, or does he even do, maybe the dog doesn't even attack him. We don't even see that. So maybe it doesn't happen.
True.
Maybe they're lying. But I like the idea of Albert putting a spell on the dog.
Mm-hmm.
This was also the scene where Miss Tanner is berating him, where the mark is where the Nazi vibe really sort of struck me. And mm-hmm. I started noticing more and more of that kind of thing, you know, fascism, Nazism, sort of continuing in other parts of the movie too. And I'm curious if there's, you know, if that's is an intentional element. I mean, as obviously there are elements of that are intentional, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but I don't know that it's an allegory, but it's certainly, drawing attention to fascism and the kinds of, you know, political totalitarianism that the remnants of still exist in this world that we're in here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a second, we'll also see more of the links to the Nazis. I don't know what. So Argento was born in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he would have been very young, but his family would have lived through the effects of fascism with Mussolini. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was a very conscious choice to make that connection.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Tanner is absolutely furious. She kicks Daniel out of the school, but as he's leaving, he's like, I may be blind, but I'm not deaf. So what does he know about the witches?
He's heard the snoring too.
Exactly. That night, Sarah goes to visit Susie and she's like, the teachers are all leaving, but we hear someone walking in the hallway. Susie's like, I don't think they're leaving. It sounds like they're going further into the school. So Sarah's interest is piqued and she is determined to find out where they really go. So the camera kind of pans down the different hallways until we see this open window looking out on a full moon.
Mm-hmm.
So Daniel does what I would do if I just lost my job and lived in Germany. He heads to a beer hall. There is a Lederhosen-filled dance scene before he heads out and that tinkling music begins. Kind of sounds like a music box, I feel like, that particular theme.
It does. Yeah, with the mm-hmm. ballerina inside and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His dog starts barking, but we don't see anyone around as they are alone in this big empty square. So this empty square is actually Königsplatz, which has a tie into Nazi Germany because they had rallies there.
Yeah, I mean, like the eagle gargoyle and stuff.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, this is where I guess I was like, okay, fascism, you know, because honestly, I had forgotten that, oh yeah, this movie takes place in Germany because I was thinking Italy.
Yeah.
You know, and so I sort of drew, because it's very Romanesque, that architecture in there too. So I was started thinking, you know, like Julius Caesar and the Senate and the killing on the steps and, you know, my mind went all sorts of crazy directions during this, you know, the police are wearing, you know, sort of these long coats, you know, that make them sort of look like SS mm-hmm. officers. And it was striking to me. Then it just sort of like, maybe I'm reading too much into this as I went along with the movie, but during this scene in particular, it's really strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all absolutely.
That imagery is very strong.
Yeah. Especially with the shadows of the witches against that gargoyle and that edifice of,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. Which is such a great scene. And it was probably accomplished really simply, but it's really effective.
The way that the scene is shot too, just makes Daniel seem so vulnerable and exposed because there's nothing around him. We get the like overhead shots again. And you wonder where that danger is coming from because you know it's there. The dog is barking. The dog, you always listen to the animal in horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel screams, "Who's there?" repeatedly, but we just zoom in on that eagle statue before the perspective changes and we fly down towards Daniel and we hear wings flapping very loudly. The shadows of the witches fly by the buildings as the music intensifies and you're just waiting for someone to attack. But unfortunately, it's Daniel's dog who attacks and lunges for his throat and takes him down.
And the thing is, every time I watch this, I always forget that that's what happens. Because I'm like, oh, he's being attacked by, you know, the eagle statue or whatever is flying down at him. And then all of a sudden his dog turns on him. It's like, oh, shit. I forgot about that.
It's such a good misdirect because you don't see it coming. Like, it does everything. The scene makes you think that it's going to be something coming at him, not his loyal dog sitting next to him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The dog just begins to feast on him. Like, you literally see him tear some flesh.
Right? He's just like making jerky out of his throat. I love it.
And two men see what's happened in the distance. They race over, but it is too late for poor Daniel.
And I love that the cops didn't hear him screaming, didn't hear the dog barking. But when everything's quiet and it's too late to do anything, then they're like, oh, hey, maybe we stroll over and help this man.
Yeah, exactly. As you would expect, the talk at school the next day is all about Daniel's death. And one of the students casually refers to Pat's death as well, causing someone else to hit the nail on the head when she's like, maybe there's a hex on the place. Let's call in an exorcist. Not a bad idea. Susie goes to see Madame Blanc and she shares her concerns about Daniel and Pat's death, but she just kind of dismisses them. She's like, it's nothing. Don't worry about it. So then later, Sarah and Susie go to the indoor pool and Sarah tells Susie that she shouldn't have told Madame Blanc about what she heard the night of Pat's murder. She's like, it's put them on the hunt for somebody, she says. Sarah tells her that Pat was speaking to her when she was leaving the school that night, and she's the one that refused to let Susie in. So she's very concerned, like, what's going to happen to me because of this? Pat had been taking notes on some events that had been happening around the school, and she had given those notes to Sarah before leaving, and she's going to let Susie read them that night. Doesn't quite happen. So the notes are actually stolen that very same day. Sarah is freaking out and tries to rouse Susie later that night, but she's been drinking her red wine again and is pretty much out of it. I used to think that Susie just drank a lot of wine, but as I got older and more cynical, I was like, oh no, they drugged her.
Yeah. Absolutely. But that moment when Sarah is trying to wake her up and Susie is kind of fading out of consciousness, when it fades to black and Sarah says, do you know anything about witches? Like, it's a total inverse of the use of witch before, when it was a bright white light and it was this like weird echo effect. They fade to black on that word and give it like the inverse audio effect, which I think is so brilliant that it's the total reverse of what we've seen up until this point.
Sarah is bathed in this green light and she tells Susie, I know where the teachers go. Susie, however, never comes to full consciousness at this point. Sarah hears noises in the hallway. So she's like, I better get away. She should have got away a long time before this.
Yeah.
There's more green light as Sarah turns off the light, and now the entire scene is just in green. She sees a light go on in the hallway, and she sneaks out of another door just as someone enters the room. She runs through that red hallway, but goes up through the hatch into the attic, and we see a vague figure of someone following her. And then we get this shot of a box with two pearl pins and a knife as the stalker opens it. Sarah's cautiously walking through that attic storeroom where we saw the maggot crate earlier. And she accidentally opens the door. And she moves away for it before something comes in her face. And she falls into a glass door. It cuts her, but she manages to get into another room, locks the door behind her. Her assailant is undeterred. And they use a knife to try to jimmy the lock open.
Yeah, that I find that really, really scary.
That's terrifying.
When that, I don't know if it's like a straight razor or something that is pushing through the gap in the door there to try and push over that latch. That's really suspenseful.
And it is, and you just see it moving.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're so persistent. They just keep trying and getting almost there. It's so terrifying that they're using the weapon to try to get in the door. And the moment right before that, when they reach out and attack her, I had never noticed the flashing eyes behind Sarah right before that happens. I saw a tweet just a week or two ago where someone had manipulated the exposure to reveal the person standing behind her. And I flipped out. I was like, what? I've never noticed this before. Please, someone help me. My entire life doesn't make sense anymore. Because I had never seen it in my life. But yeah, that whole sequence, especially with the straight razor and the lock, is just, it's just perfect suspense.
It's sort of a callback to his Giallo days, yes. You know, sort of the best of that. Because, Suspiria is not a Giallo. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't really be lumped in there. It's something very different from that. Mm-hmm. Even though, it latches on to a few of the conventions, but it disposes of a lot of them too.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just something else.
I feel like it gets lumped in.
It does. That
subgenre a lot. And I think it's just because it's Argento.
Exactly. I think so. People hear Argento and say, oh, it's a Giallo. So,
yeah.
But no, we are all saying definitively that Suspiria is not a Giallo.
The werewolf squad has spoken.
Yeah. Hear us howl.
So who is chasing her? Who do you think that is? Is it Pavlos? Because he goes looking for Susie later.
I don't think, for some reason, I don't think Pavlos is that nimble. I'm not trying to be insulting, but.
No, I think you're right.
Is it Mark?
I don't think so.
It's Albert.
Let's say it's Albert.
I mean, cats are nimble, so.
They are. They absolutely are.
So Sarah's backing away slowly as the assailant's trying to jimmy that lock open, and she sees a window. Like up on the wall, that she's like, I can escape through that. Mm-hmm. So she pulls over a whole bunch of crates and boxes, and she manages to climb through and sees that on the other side of that room, there's an ajar door, except that there's a pit of razor wire between her and that door, and she doesn't make it through the razor wire.
Razor wire without any razors on it.
What is this room? Because there are like farm tools hanging on the wall, and there's barbed wire on the floor with no barbs on it. I really want to know what this room is, besides just
weird.
The witch's torture chamber that we had built into the academy.
Into the attic.
Like, right? I'm
Well, there's a lot of architecture to this building that doesn't make a lot of sense.
True.
And sort of, Rubik's cubes around.
Absolutely.
In different ways.
Yeah. Did that room come into existence when Sarah happened upon it and vanish out of existence once she was dead? Like, did it just appear just to do that to her? Because there's no logical reason for this room to exist.
It appeared just so Saw could rip it off 25, 30 years later.
Suspiria walked so Saw could run.
Yeah, there you go.
I feel dirty just saying that. I'm so sorry.
Stefania Cassini had a difficult time with this scene because even though that wire is fake, the coils still got wrapped around her.
I'm shocked. It's fake.
I know.
Say it ain't so.
It's the magic of filmmaking.
Oh, yeah. What's funny, it's like they don't even try.
Right. She's stuck in a slinky and just screaming.
Exactly. None of these criticisms are really criticisms.
Right,
they're just sort of funny ways to talk about, just how bonkers this is.
And
but the nightmare logic of it is brilliant in its way too. I mean, there's nothing at any moment where I'm like, that it takes me out of it.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I say with affection because I'm there with you. I'm a huge fan of dream logic and nightmare logic. And this movie just taps into that so brilliantly.
Well, if you've heard our Nightmare on Elm Street episode of Movies for Life, we really talk about nightmare logic and how nobody understands that movie correctly. Because I am 100% right about that movie and no one else is. I'm kidding.
Bang the gavel.
I'm joking.
The coils of wire would get wrapped around her and pinch her. Not a fan of that scene.
I don't blame her.
I wouldn't be either. Yeah.
Her assailant shows up and cuts her throat with that straight razor.
It's a very that meaty cut.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's
so meaty is a good word for it.
It's a good word for it.
It's not gory. It's just gross.
Yeah, there's no blood. It's like cutting into a well-done steak.
Yeah.
I'm here with all the disgusting similes. You're welcome.
I love it. The next morning, Susie's looking for her friend, and Miss Tanner's like, oh, she snuck out like a thief early that morning. And Mark's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I heard the car. That's the his big contribution to the movie.
Thanks, Mark. Good job.
Susie, however, is persistent, and she reaches out to one of Sarah's friends and asks to see him. So this scene has the most exposition of any scene in the movie. And it's all about them witches.
Okay. I'm going to bring in my second off-topic story here. For starters, Udo Kier was super upset that they used another actor to dub his lines because he didn't have a firm grasp of English at the time. So they didn't let him do, you know, his own dubbing. But my story is when I took my little Suspiria picture at Texas Frightmare, Enter Sandman was playing.
Oh.
And Udo Kier dances up to me, grabs my arm, and points at Stefania Cassini, who was in Blood for Dracula with him. And he says, can you imagine 40 years ago I was biting her? I was the vampire and she was the victim. I still have not recovered. I like that was legitimately one of the best things that's ever happened to me in my life. So I just wanted to record it for posterity and let you know that Udo Kier is as weird in person as you think he is and is as marvelous in person as you think he is.
You know, I think I think my co-host Michelle was also there because she has said that Udo Kier was hilarious.
He was. He was so funny. But I just every time I hear Metallica now, I just think about Udo Kier dancing up to me. Yeah. Oh, good times.
Brilliant.
I kind of love this scene because at first I was like, I didn't realize it was him because I'm probably most familiar with him from Shadow of the Vampire. Mm-hmm. So he's much older, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was even noticing like the way he's drinking his juice is like really awkward. and I thought it's kind of brilliant though. I love what he's doing in this scene. It's just like, it's very odd. It's very odd. And I like that a lot about
it's everything kind of he does is captivating.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he confirms that Sarah has not gone home to her father's like Miss Tanner had suggested. But he tells Susie that Sarah was one of his patients. She had a mental breakdown a few years ago after her mother's death, but then they kind of became friends after she recovered. So he's like, I've been a little concerned about her. She's been having all kinds of wild ideas. And he goes on to tell Susie that the Academy was originally a joint dance / occult school.
And, as you do.
As you do, and was founded by Helena Marcos, a Greek immigrant that locals believed was a witch. She'd been expelled from other European countries because of her wild beliefs, and she was known as the Black Queen, but was killed in a fire. One of her favored pupils took over the school. And that pupil was like, we're going to push aside the occult studies in public and just focus on the dance. So the doctor, he's very dismissive of the witch theory. He says, I believe in broken minds, not broken mirrors and bad luck.
Such a good line.
Such a good line. But he's like, I'm going to introduce you to a colleague of mine, Professor Milius, who is an expert in the field of the occult. So it's like he kind of just says all that about how I don't believe in the occult. But then I'm going to introduce you to this expert in the occult, which is amazing. And you know what blew my mind about the professor? One of my favorite horror movies, and I've seen it so many times, is The Exorcist. I never realized that the professor is Carl from The Exorcist.
What?
Wait, what?
What?
Yeah. It's Rudolf Schindler, who is Carl from The Exorcist.
Oh, man.
Okay. I feel much better now.
Wait, I don't know The Exorcist nearly as well as I know this movie, but you're kind of blowing my mind right now, too. Oh my God. To be fair, he doesn't have that hair in The Exorcist.
He does not have that hair. That's true. That is true.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You've stunned us into silence.
And I mean, he's dubbed, so it's not the same voice. You don't,
Oh my gosh. I'm looking at the pictures like, holy crap. It is him. Jeez.
Okay, I feel way better now, so
good.
Thank you. He tells her that he has met women that claim to be witches, but Susie's very skeptical. And she's like, well, what do they do? And here comes the doom and gloom. They're evil. They're wicked. They have tremendous power. They only do harm. And as Jessica alluded to earlier, they do it basically to gain incredible wealth. So he then says that Helena Marcos was a mistress of magic. And the way that he talks about the talent that she had, he kind of seems to admire her a little bit. Mm-hmm. We learn that a coven of witches is powerless without their leader. He actually refers to a coven without its leader as a headless cobra. So we get more snake references. Mm-hmm. And despite her skepticism, the professor tells Susie that magic is everywhere.
Yeah.
As, you know, we see not them talking, but a reflection of them talking in a window, suggesting mm-hmm. that someone is always watching Susie.
Mm-hmm. So back at the school, Susie does not eat dinner. She does not drink her wine. In fact, she dumps it down the sink. And it doesn't act like normal wine does.
No, it doesn't. It's very painty.
I mean, not that I've ever dumped out a glass of wine. Let's be honest. So she's starting to catch on. But she's the only one left in the school. Everyone else has gone to the theater, she's told. So she calls Frank, the psychologist, to discuss what's been happening just before the power goes out momentarily due to the storm that is once again raging outside. Mm-hmm. And she is disconnected. Back in her room, she turns off the light. We see yellow disembodied eyes fading in and out behind a glass paneled door. She's braver than I ever would be because she opens that door.
Right? Oh, yeah. That door would never open again.
Nope. She doesn't see anything initially, but in flies a bat, and this bat is agitated.
Right? Another 70s Italian horror staple, a bat gets stuck in someone's hair.
Yeah. And this is the craziest looking bat, too. You know the rubber bat in Dracula?
Yes.
It's better than that. But jeez, it's like got this fat little body and these little wings, but it looks like a clockwork and the fangs and that mouth
is wide open with just like teeth. Yeah.
It's a very strange. I think it's Albert as a bat.
Yeah, there we go.
Because we see him later, but hey.
No. That's true. It can't be him because he would not be alive anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Also, Brian, don't fat shame the bat.
I didn't mean to fat shame the bat.
Thank you, Sherry.
My bad. Yeah, not my intention to fat shame the bat.
Yeah, it is a very strange looking bat. Yeah.
It's a very strange looking bat.
I do think it is one of the witches, just not our favorite cat, Albert.
Probably. Like, it's attacking her, it lands on the floor, and then it moves along the floor. Just continuing towards it. And this is how we know it's not Albert, because she covers it with a blanket and squishes it. Mm-hmm. And we see blood through the blanket.
Yes.
The lighting is kind of going back and forth between red and blue throughout the scene. And she finds the note that Sarah left her, basically telling her that she figured out where the teachers go and how she figured out where they go. So Susie hears footsteps and she's like, I'm going to count their footsteps and I can also find out where they go. Susie, whether this is brave or stupid, she heads out into the hallway to see where the teachers are heading. So she has a close call with that kitchen hand from earlier who hypnotized her, but she manages to elude her before finding where the footsteps stop. So it's this fancy parlor kind of room. Susie realizes there has to be another way out before she sees a painting with irises on it. This, of course, makes her think of the night she arrived at the school when she heard Pat say something about irises. Turn the blue one, she said. So Susie, of course, turns the blue one, enters this room enveloped in blue curtains before entering this long curving hallway with gold paintings, words in different languages written on the walls. And she creeps quietly forward to see the teachers gathered in a room at the end of the hall. Madame Blanc has set aside her civility and manners, saying they must make that bitch of an American girl vanish. She must die. And she calls upon Helena to give her power as she seems to take a sort of like perverted communion. She then calls for sickness and death for Susie, who reacts viscerally before then seeing the maimed body of her friend, Sarah.
With the pins in her eyes.
With the pins in her eyes.
Oh, how they even did that. I
know. It's so disturbing.
It really is. And I trauma is a thing for me, you know? Yeah. So
yeah.
I watched Dead and Buried recently, and there's, you know, a hypodermic needle in an eye in that movie.
So you're a big Fulci fan then, yeah.
Oh, geez, I can't. Oh. I haven't seen a lot of Fulci because, you know, eye scene, the splinter scene in Zombie. But
I'm sorry, but I love that scene so much.
it just makes me go,
I get it.
Whenever somebody puts their eye up to like a keyhole or something in a movie, I'm always
don't do that.
Yeah. And she's also nailed to like, what is she lying on? Like an altar or like a,
she's like crucified almost with the nails through her wrists. Yeah.
And Susie sees Pavlos walking down the hall with, incidentally, Sarah's lighter that he had admired earlier in the movie.
Which is such a beautiful shot. It tracks the lighter as it moves down the hallway. Mm-hmm. Before we started recording, I said my only contribution the entire time would just be say, that was a pretty shot. So this is my obligatory, that was so beautiful moment.
She ducks into this side door where she hears the loud wheezing snoring that we heard in the slumber party scene before seeing a figure sleeping on the bed, kind of surrounded by those gauzy curtains that I always wanted when I was a little kid.
I did too.
This room has the best neon peacock, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The bird with the crystal plumage.
Yes.
And Susie panics. She starts to back out of the room before she sees Pavlos. And in her fright, she knocks over the peacock and what look and sound like bowling balls.
Yeah.
This wakes the person in the bed up and they say, "Who is it? Who's there?" This raspy voiced person is Helena Marcos, and she's been expecting Susie, she says. So Susie has grabbed one of the peacock's glass feathers, which is brilliant. Yeah. And she's approaching the bed. Helena is mocking her, saying, "You want to kill me?" I can't even do the voice.
It's that voice. I can see some of the Exorcist comparisons because it does sound like Mercedes McCambridge a tiny bit because it's so guttural and unnatural and it doesn't seem like it should be coming from a human or one human, you know, it's really disturbing.
Yeah. And her laugh.
Oh God. Yeah.
It's awful. But Susie opens those curtains around the bed. There's no one there, just an indent on the mattress. So she turns around. Helena continues to mock her, telling her that death is coming for you. And we see the doorknob slowly start to turn before it opens to reveal Sarah, the reanimated corpse of Sarah, at least laughing gruesomely, knife raised. And she approaches Susie, who is quivering in fear. And this is, for me, my most iconic shot.
Yeah, that's her cowering by the window. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Bathed in that red and blue light.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
There's my, it's beautiful. She turns back to the bed and she sees this weird glowy outline of Helena on the bed. She stabs at the outline and that causes Helena Marcos's full decrepit form to appear. Sarah basically vanishes once she stabs Helena, but Helena is still reaching for Susie. She is nasty and her death scene is equally nasty.
And she's got the hairy arms and the claws. So maybe she is part werewolf.
Exactly.
Yeah, she does have those big black claws. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The room begins to shudder. Furniture is flying around the room. The chandelier explodes. So Susie makes the wise choice to flee the chaos. Mm-hmm. And this finale was inspired by a dream that Daria Nicoletti had. She said, in a dream, she encountered an invisible witch, and there was a panther in the room with her that suddenly exploded. And there's actually a porcelain panther that explodes in the scene. Don't forget what Professor Milia said, though. Kill the head of the snake and the rest are powerless. Mm-hmm. In fact, we see the rest of the coven is not doing so well. Pavlos appears to be bleeding from all of his facial orifices. Miss Tanner looks like she's being pulled in multiple directions, while Madame Blanc looks like she's being strangled. What is Albert doing? How did I not notice what Albert's doing in this scene? Or is Albert in the scene? He must be, unless he's reverted to a cat.
Albert's the only one who escapes because he became a cat and used one of his lives to get out.
There you go. Everything is going poorly. Wind is ripping through the school. Walls are cracking. Windows are breaking. But finally, Susie makes it outside in the pouring rain, which is beautiful cinematic symmetry. Mm-hmm. Just as the building bursts into flames, and she smiles and she's laughing because she's free from the witches. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then on the screen, as you mentioned earlier, Jessica, when you talked about the first time you watched it, yeah, you have been watching Suspiria.
Oh, so good.
That's so good.
What did we just watch again?
What was the name of the movie?
Yeah. Inferno. So what stood out for you beyond the things that we've already talked about?
Well, the only thing scarier than the last 12 minutes is the first 92.
So. Exactly. Now, there was one moment that struck me on this rewatch that I wanted to ask y'all about. There's a moment where Pavlos is leaving Susie's room, and as he's shutting the door, he looks directly into the camera. And I can't imagine that that was an accident. It could have been, for all I know. Mm. But that, for some reason, it doesn't feel like an accident to me. And I am scrolling back up through my notes to see if I can figure out where it is. Yeah, it's after Daniel is kicked out of the school, but before Daniel is killed. And it's right before Sarah realizes that if you count the teacher's steps, you can figure out where they're going. He looks right into the camera when he closes the door to the room. And I recently did a rewatch of Carnival of Souls where Candace Hilligoss looks directly into the camera in a scene. So I'm kind of attuned to that right now, like looking for the significance in it. So I'm very curious about what the importance of that is. It could have just been the actor couldn't resist but looking into the camera, for all I know, and I'm reading way too much into it. But
usually when a character looks at the camera, it's a fourth wall break, you know, in the sense that it's connecting directly with the audience in some way. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's
read into.
I'm not sure what to make of it. I'm not sure if they're trying to imply that there was another person in the room with them unseen and he was looking at that person, but why would they implicate the audience in that? But again,
or maybe the witches are out in the audience with us.
Ooh, I like that. Mm-hmm.
Or it could just be, you know, Jessica go touch grass challenge. So I'm reading too much into it again. Yeah, that just struck me, and I just thought, what an odd little detail to throw in.
I bet you're right. I bet, like, it's probably something, like, it was probably intentional. Mm-hmm. Because everything in this movie is so intentional, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it is. You know, witches are among us. You know, when you leave the theater tonight, when you hear wings on the wind, it's not a bat or a bird, it's a witch. You know, just to kind of
remember. There are such things. We'll talk about that in the Dracula episodes. getting way ahead of us there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Or is it like a way to like bring you further into the narrative? Like he's like watching us as well. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I like the witches in the audience though. Mm-hmm. I think that's good. There's witches everywhere.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and watch that again.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like sitting here listening to this, like I did not notice nearly as much as you two did. I'm just like, I feel like, whoa, jeez, wow. So this has been very enlightening to me, and I got to go watch the movie again. And
I want to go watch this again right now. But yeah, you both might watch it and say, Jessica, he's not looking into the camera, but I swear he looks into the camera for a split second.
You know, though, it ties in with when Professor Milius says they're everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. They're everywhere all the time. Brian, anything for you? Anything that stood out for you that we haven't talked about?
I not that I can think of. I mean, like you two took me much farther into the movie than I had ever been before. So,
yes.
So hey, right? We're good.
I feel like we're I accomplished good. Something.
I mean, I felt like I was onto something with that whole Nazi thing.
Hey, you like, were. You were.
Totally.
And then it was like, oh, it's done. It's just that one part.
Obviously, the primary colors play a big role in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, you know, it plays into the technicolor. It plays into the idea of like wanting kind of this fairy tale, something very basic, very bold. Mm. It seems like the blue, the yellow, and the red, or yeah, the blue, the yellow, and the red, even like the stained glass at the beginning that Pat falls through, those are the colors that are on that stained glass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those seem to be used for very specific effects. Like I said, the red, I think, kind of signals that evil is nearby or around somewhere. But do you think that there's a very specific connotation to the blue or to the yellow or even the green?
Honestly, my last rewatch, especially that scene with Sarah in the room as Susie's asleep and everything is green, I thought, I need to watch this movie again and only look at the colors and try to figure out what I think is happening with each of these colors. Because this is such a feast for the eyes. Even if you put it on mute, like the people who suggested that it would be better if it were a silent movie, even if you put it on mute and just watch this movie, there's so much happening that it's hard for me to focus in on one thing. But mm-hmm. I would very much like to watch it again and just pay attention to what I think is happening with each color, because I know something's going on that I just haven't picked up on yet. So I'm sorry, I just heard a very strange noise and it scared the hell out of me. So, but to long story short, I don't know. That's a very roundabout way to say I don't know, but I did hear something very creepy. So
what did you hear?
It sounded like someone yelling. It was almost like a yodel, but like in distress.
Oh.
And I'm kind of terrified to leave the room right now. I'm not going to lie to you. So we're just going to keep talking about witches.
Okay. If you hear anything else, let us know.
I will. I will.
Yeah, I don't know either. I just suspect I'm like, there's got to be a very specific use of each color that I'm just not picking up on. Mm-hmm. Like even at the beginning when you've got the arrivals and departures board at the airport, there's kind of like this yellow tinge to it.
Yeah.
Like it's contaminated by the outside world, the world outside of the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Body count. If we don't count the witches, because I never count the villains, we had Pat, Sonia, Sarah, and Daniel. On a scale of 1 through 5, how many scaredy cat screams would you give it?
5. This to me is like 5 out of 5, 10 out of 10, however many. This is one of the best movies I've ever seen. I don't care that the plot doesn't necessarily make sense, because like mm-hmm. we said, it's, you know, it's dream logic, it's nightmare logic, it's, you know, a fairy tale to scare children, even though those children are us and I'm sitting here scared in my room. I just, on visuals alone, this is one of the best films ever made to me.
Nice. This may come as a shock from some of the things I've said, but I agree. This is a 5 out of 5.
I would agree. I like that you have to preface it. You're like, this might come as a shock, but.
Well, I did give American Werewolf in London a 4, you know.
So. There is that. True.
And they still let me write articles. It's amazing.
It's funny because every time I see somebody like since we recorded that episode, every time I see somebody talking about what a perfect movie American Werewolf in London is, I'm like, Brian doesn't think so.
Yeah. Brian disagrees, so you're wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Everybody agree with me on everything. That's the only way society can function.
Exactly.
Oh, sometimes the way Twitter acts, you would think that is.
I know. It's so ridiculous.
Oh my God.
That's why I'm taking a little bit of a Twitter fast at the moment.
I really should do that sometimes.
I should too. I tend not to share opinions. I definitely don't share negative opinions on Twitter. I just tend to be like, I love this movie. I love this movie. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And I also don't chime in if somebody loves something and I don't go, I don't love it.
Yeah, that's a dick move. It is. Sorry. I don't know how else to say it.
Like, why?
Why would you do that?
Yeah. There's a difference between, you know, let's have a conversation about this movie and you tell me what you like and what you don't know. If I just say, I love Suspiria, and somebody comes in like, I don't know, it was boring. Get out of my mentions with that.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah, exactly. Just keep it to yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
The remake. Quick thoughts on the remake.
I don't have many thoughts because I saw it once and mm-hmm. I was kind of lost, and I think that I I probably wasn't paying close enough attention to it, to be honest with you. So I'm intrigued enough by it to give it another viewing. Mm-hmm. Because I think it has some really interesting things going for it.
Yeah, I've seen it two or three times at this point. The first time I hated it so much, because yep. I'm obsessed with the original and I was comparing it to the original. After that, mm-hmm. I think it's a very interesting movie that I have not determined my opinion on yet. I don't know what I make of it. It's not that I don't understand it. I'm just not sure what I think about it, but it's mm-hmm. interesting. That's for sure. Mm-hmm.
You can't really compare it to the original.
Oh, no. It's so different.
In any way. It's mm-hmm. just a completely different animal.
Yeah.
I think what they're trying to do is completely different.
Absolutely.
It's in this movie, it's essentially, bad witches, whereas it's not that cut and dry in the remake.
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. And they're doing a lot more explicitly with Nazism and with politics in the remake. Mm-hmm. And, as we discussed, a lot more with dance, obviously, mm-hmm. completely changing up the roles. I don't mean like who plays what, but like what role Susie plays in the narrative and things like that. And, mm-hmm. but aesthetically, the remake looks like a 70s movie, whereas Suspiria, the original, does not really, because nothing looks like Suspiria 77. But the remake looks, it has that kind of washed out, grainy look that I associate mm-hmm. with certain 70s films, which I think is really interesting and really smart that they didn't try to replicate the colors and the cinematography of the original, because you just can't do it. So it's an interesting movie that I still can't make up my mind on, and I probably never will, to be honest.
I am in exactly the same camp. Like, I feel exactly, I've only seen it twice. The first time, same thing, hated it. I was like, nope, don't like this. Mm-hmm. And the second time, okay, a little better, but I still don't know. I don't know what side I come down on it. So probably will never cover it on the podcast, but right. Whatever.
Yeah.
So. What I think about the original Suspiria, as far as you're right, nothing looks like it. But if I was to compare what Argento's doing in this to something, I would say like Vertigo or Marnie or A Clockwork Orange to some extent, maybe, or like 2001, where there are these really strong colors and there's really sure direction, and you know that everything that appears in the frame is meant to be there.
Yeah, I really like the Vertigo comparison.
Yeah, I think Vertigo and maybe Marnie are probably the ones that evoke it the most to me, because color is, when Hitchcock, when he used color, he used it on purpose.
Oh, yeah.
There was no, and I love that about movies that were made in the 50s or, even before that, if they use color in movies before 1960, even, they're using color on purpose, they're really thinking about how to use the color. Whereas by the 70s, it's like, we're just capturing the naturalistic look,
right?
Mm-hmm. That's what, because everything was in color by that point.
Yeah.
So Suspiria feels like a bit of a throwback. It almost looks more like a 50s film than a 70s film. Mm-hmm. Just in that deliberate decision and use of color.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I like that you reference Hitchcock, because Argento is a big Hitchcock aficionado. And
clearly.
Yeah. Like, even the bat scene, like, it reminds me of Tippi Hedren in The Birds.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Like, the way she puts her hands up and is just like, it's got kind of that same vibe. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, and the blood in something like The Birds looks, is that really, really red,
It's weird too, like, the, you're talking about the 70s being very naturalistic in the way that movies were shot, and the very few scenes that you get that have that kind of naturalistic lighting in Suspiria, like, feel jarring. Like there's that one part where she's running through when she's trying at the end to get to the room to follow the teachers. And there's that kind of like pine paneling wall. And that's mm-hmm. very naturalistic, like lighting in that. And it just like kind of puts you off kilter because you become accustomed to these bright, bold colors.
Yeah. And when she's outdoors with Sarah's friend, the psychiatrist, and with the occult expert, it's very jarring seeing them kind of outdoors, mm-hmm. not with all these neon colors everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And also Mark's death is so dark. It's almost black and white, you know, and red.
Yeah.
it's kind of almost all you see. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that was not as wild a ride as I thought it was going to be.
Sorry to disappoint.
No. I mean, it was easier to talk about the narrative than I expected. So that's good.
Yeah, likewise.
Thanks for coming on and talking about Suspiria. It was a delight having both of you back on the show, as always. So tell us where we can find you.
You can find me on Twitter at We Who Walk Here. I've got, you know, I write for Film Cred, Daily Grindhouse, Ghouls Mag. I have my portfolio and post my pieces all the time. But yeah, come say hi to me at We Who Walk Here. Let's geek out over Suspiria together.
You can find me on Twitter as well when I'm not, you know, taking a break. even though I do pop in every now and then anyway. So at Brian D. Kuiper. And you can find my writing. Most of what I do is on Bloody Disgusting right now. They keep on taking my pitches. It's amazing.
I love it.
I feel shocked. I'm kind of shocked every time I get a new slate of pitches accepted. but then also Council of Zoom when I can, and Manor Vellum pretty much monthly as well. And also, if you want to check out the Movies for Life podcast, we're at Movie Life Pod on Twitter, and you can find info there on some cool stuff that we have. We're about to start recording a couple of spooky season episodes.
Yay, so. Love it. I have to catch up because I am a little behind on your episodes, but I gotta
it's
do that.
It's all good. I am excited. I hope I'm curious to hear your reaction to the Nightmare on Elm Street one.
I have to say that both of you have like incredible articles and stuff. So listeners, please check out both of them because it always amazes me the things that both of you write about. It's absolutely incredible. So
thank you so much.
Both of you always bring some excellent perspective. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I was so thrilled to be able to talk about this movie just because I love it so much. And I'm glad that I didn't just say that was pretty every 5 seconds.
Thank you for joining us today. You can catch us on Twitter at @CatScaredy and on Instagram at @ScaredyCats the podcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts and don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.